Speech in the name of one God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Please be seated. It will probably come as no surprise to all of you that I enjoy the Bible, that I like reading the Bible. And there are several stories in the Bible that are really important to me. For example, the story of Esther, that's found in the book of Esther, was really important to me during my time of discernment into ordained ministry. And then on my wedding band and on my husband's wedding band, we have a verse from the book of Ruth inscribed on it. But overall, I agree with what Amy Jo Levine has said about the Bible. Amy Jo Levine is a pretty famous theologian. She is a Jewish theologian who talks both about Judaism and Christianity. And she says that the Bible in its entirety is a literary piece of art. And the reason for this is that because the Bible is able to elicit a full range of emotions from those who read it. Meaning that there should be stories in the Bible that confuse you. There should be stories that are suspenseful, that maybe raise your anxiety level a little bit as you try to figure out what's going to happen. There should be stories that are meaningful and touching that maybe make you cry. And there should be stories that are so hilarious you roll on the floor laughing. The Bible should elicit an entire range of emotion for those who are reading it. And the second reason the Bible is a literary work of art is because the characters represented in the Bible are important. And I'm going to take Jesus out of the Bible just for a second. I know I probably shouldn't do that, but he doesn't work in my analogy, so I'm going to put him back in a second. But if you remove Jesus from the Bible for one whole second, all of the other characters in the Bible are perfectly human, meaning that they make terrible decisions. They make awful mistakes. They are completely sinful. They are imperfect in every sense of the word. Abraham tells people that his wife, Sarah, is actually his sister, so he can sell her into slavery. So, I mean, they make really bad decisions. But the Bible as a whole, when you put Jesus back in, you get a perfect person. But the Bible as a whole has characters that we can identify with. Or we can identify against ourselves and say, well, at least we're not quite that bad. We haven't done that yet. But the Bible as a whole has people that we can identify with. Maybe we want to identify with Naomi from the book of Ruth. Naomi means pleasant. And the reading starts with telling us that her name means pleasant. And then she goes through a lot of tragedies. And then she changes her name to Mara because she is pissed off. Mara means pissed off. It should make you laugh. It's pretty hilarious that she changes her name from pleasant to ticked off. But the whole point of the Bible is that these are wonderful stories that elicit some amount of emotion from us. We've been in the Gospels. We read the Gospel every Sunday, as you know, and we've been in the Gospel of John for a few weeks now. And of all of the miracles that are portrayed in the four Gospels and all of the miracles that Jesus does and everything that happens in Jesus's life, the miracle of raising Lazarus from the dead is by far my very favorite miracle of Jesus. And it's not because Lazarus was raised from the dead. The miracle itself is kind of contradictory to why I like the story. It's a cool feature. It's a climactic ending to the story, but it's not actually why I like the story. It's a nice ending, but why I like the story is what happens with Jesus before the raising of Lazarus. So we're told in our reading that Lazarus is Jesus's friend. Jesus has 12 disciples, as you know. Disciples is another word for students. So he has 12 people who follow him around to learn from him. And through all of the readings, we know that people flock to hear Jesus's message. Crowds press upon him. He gets on boats because there are so many people. There are always people around Jesus. But Jesus has very few friends. Jesus has very few people that he shows up to their house and he gets to just be Jesus. Not Jesus of Nazareth, not Jesus the Messiah, not Jesus, I'm trying to figure out who you are because you do these cool miracles, just Jesus. And Lazarus and Martha and Mary are his friends. He appears numerous times in their house. He goes to them because he just gets to be himself. And so we're told that he loves Lazarus, and Lazarus has fallen ill. And then Jesus takes 2 full days before he even decides to go to Bethany. And then he tells his disciples 2 days before he even decides to go to Bethany that Lazarus is going to fall asleep and that he is going to awaken him and that the glory of God is going to be revealed through Lazarus's death. And the disciples get confused and they say, well, if he's just sleeping, it's all good. And Jesus has to tell them, no, he's dead. So he knows before he gets to Bethany that Lazarus has died. He knows that he's going to raise him from the dead and he knows that the glory of God is going to be revealed. He knows all of that before he gets to Bethany. Then he gets to Bethany, and he's met first with Martha. And Martha greets him with this response, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. She greets him with anger. She believes that if Jesus hadn't waited the two full days to get to Bethany, Lazarus would not have died. Can you imagine the pain that she must be feeling? She believes if her friend hadn't waited, her brother would not be dead. And then he goes on this whole point about resurrection, and she says, okay, I believe that he'll raise on the last day. And that's all fine and good. But then Mary, his other sister, Lazarus's other sister, comes and greets Jesus with this response. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. The same response that Martha had. Both of them believed that their brother did not have to die and that Jesus waited too long to get there. They are both hurting and in pain. And then we're told that Jesus is taken to the grave of Lazarus and that there's a big tomb there. And what happens there is that Jesus has already said to all these people that Lazarus is going to raise from the dead. The glory of God is going to be revealed. He's not dead. He's just sleeping. All will be well. But what happens? The shortest sentence in the entire Bible is said, Jesus wept, or we said Jesus began to weep today. Jesus wept. And if you take that Greek word wept and you translate it, what it really says is Jesus is overcome by emotion and he is sobbing. It's not like one little tear falls from his eye. He is sobbing. He is snotting and sobbing. He is overcome by sheer emotion. He is sobbing at the grave of his friend Lazarus. He knows how the story is going to end. He's told people how the story is going to end, and yet he stands there weeping. And so one of the fundamental questions that pretty much every Christian asks at some point in their life is, where was God when, insert this really terrible thing happened? Where was God when the towers fell? Where was God when COVID struck? Where was God when a million people died of COVID in the US? Where was God? And they ask it personally too, of some tragedies that happened in their life. Where was God when this really awful, terrible thing happened in my life? Where exactly was God? Martha and Mary asked that question. Where was God when my brother died? Jesus answers that question for us in the story of Lazarus. He is outside the tomb weeping. And here's what Jesus does and doesn't do. Jesus doesn't offer a single platitude. He doesn't say, don't worry, he's in heaven with God. God has a plan. All will be well. Don't smile. Like, don't cry because it happened. Smile because it's happening. Things like that. He doesn't say any pleasantries. He sobs at his friend's tomb, which means that he stands outside of our tragedy and sobs with us. He is not indifferent to our pain and our suffering. He is overcome with emotion and empathy. In early COVID, I took a seminar on how to build community in COVID, just somewhat ironic because it was pretty tough to do, as you all know. But I took a seminar on how to build community, and there were 4 points to how to build authentic communities in church. And one of the points that really stuck with me was the fourth point, which was called the big old cry. And the lady said that if you can have someone in the group authentically cry, they actually have to be crying, they have to be feeling something authentic that has led to tears. If you have someone in the group who authentically cries, and you have a group of people that are authentically able to be present to them in their tears without platitudes or without trying to immediately make it better, community and trust is built. And I remember saying in that seminar, okay, but I have to tell you, crying in front of people sounds like my worst nightmare. It sounds like a terrible idea to cry in front of 50 people or 10 people or 20 people and be that vulnerable and that exposed to people. And she said, that's exactly the point. And she told me this story. And she said that when she was in college, and the details of what happened don't really matter, when she was in college, something really terrible and tragic happened to her. And she was on the floor of her dorm room sobbing in the fetal position, just sobbing. And the door of her dorm room was open and people could hear her crying. So a crowd naturally formed around her door to witness this woman on the floor in the fetal position crying. And people just, for the most part, stood there. Some people might have offered her something like, it's all gonna be okay. It's not that bad, it's okay. Some amount of pleasantries to try and make her feel better. This woman who had been in her class, who she knew her name but didn't actually know her all that well, walked straight through the crowd, got on the floor with her and held her as she sobbed. She didn't ask for the story. She didn't say what happened. She didn't offer her a pleasantry. She just held her as she cried. 30 years later, that is still her best friend. Because sometimes we want to offer words that will make a situation better. And there are no words that will make it better. So we try. We try a pleasantry. But really what human nature tells us is we need empathy and presence. We don't need words to make trauma better. We need someone who will stand in it with us. And that's ultimately what Jesus does at the grave of Lazarus. The only thing that is required from us when someone in our life undergoes something really awful and traumatic is to just be there and love them through it, because that's ultimately what God did first. Amen.